Welcome to the Budget and Policy Committee of Denver City Council. This session of the Budget and Policy Committee begins now.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us on this lovely, cooler afternoon and feet in the heat. My name is Amanda Sandoval. I chair the Budget and Policy Committee. I represent Northwest Denver. We have, even though it's a light agenda with one item, I think it's going to be a heavier discussion, our Excel franchise agreement. So with that, I'll start with introductions on my left, and then we'll start the program, I guess. Committee, sorry.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, or Madam President. I'm Diana Romero Campbell, Southeast Denver, District 4.
Good afternoon. Daryl Watson, serving the fine, District 9.
Chris Hines, serving Denver's Perfect 10.
Paul Cashman, serving Denver's really nice, District 6.
Sarah Parity, serving all y'all. I'm one of your council members at large.
All y'all.
Flor Alvidres with Lucky District 7.
Amanda Sawyer, District 5.
Chantel Lewis serving the looks in District 8.
Kevin Flynn, Southwest Denver's Council District 2, home of the highest natural point in the Mile High.
There you go. Fair enough. People die on that hill, figuratively only.
Wow.
And with that, I'll pass it over to Dottie and the mayor's office and just do introductions, and the floor is yours.
Sure. Well, welcome, everyone. I'm Cindy Patton. I am the Chief Operating Officer for Dottie. I'm here. My voice did not make it today, so I'm going to try and make it through, but, like, give me a wave if you can't hear me, if it goes out. But lots of tea and not really tea. I don't drink tea, but lots of fluids, so we're going to get through this. I'm joined today by Shannon Gifford, Deputy Chief Projects Officer in the Mayor's Office, and then Grace Ramirez she's the Senior Area Manager, Local Government and Community Affairs with Xcel Energy, and we are here to talk about the Xcel Franchise Agreement. And I will act as your travel guide throughout this journey of the world of the franchise agreement, but thankfully, you also have these real experts. We also have a cadre of different folks in the audience here, both from our city attorney's office, from Dottie, and others, to make sure that we leave here all confident around the table in our next steps with the timeline and the approvals that need to go through here in the coming months and weeks. And so the agenda today, I can drive this, right? Yes. The agenda today will cover all the nuts and bolts of the agreement, and I hope provide some clarity around why this little nuanced agreement that we've all been diving into over the last year is so important and is so beneficial to Denverites and the people in the city and county of Denver, and to all of our partners as well that you see listed in this graphic in the visual. We all benefit from this, and we're going to go through the overview of the agreement, what it covers, our goals of what we hoped to accomplish through the renegotiation of the document, and the next iteration of where we land, where we did land in the negotiation, and the specific benefits that we will see out of that draft, and then the timeline that we'll be moving through again over the next coming weeks and months and next steps. Sound good? With me so far? Great. So the overview, you may be asking, well, you all have been briefed several times, but the audience may be asking, what on earth is the franchise agreement? And we've had it for 20 years. Why on earth have I not heard of it? And why is Dottie presenting it, right? Why is this a Dottie thing? And at its heart, the franchise agreement is really a contractual right-of-way agreement that is between the municipality and a public utility, and it grants that utility access to the right-of-way to either install, maintain, or repair different facilities that serve Denverites. So it's about, in this case, Xcel infrastructure being in the public right-of-way, and the public right-of-way is being managed by Dottie. So at its heart, it's a infrastructure agreement and a right-of-way agreement, and that's why I'm here. And Xcel has been a longtime partner of the city, 150 years, I believe, in some way, shape, or form, different names throughout that, gas and electric, I think Denver Gas and Electric, the public service company, and probably some others. And uniquely in Denver, we vote to approve the franchise agreement, and that goes all the way back to 1906, I believe. And if you want to know why it was 1906, just Google the election of 1904, which was probably the most corrupt election in Denver history. It's a wild story. It's honestly completely bonkers, and it will explain why Denverites said, "Oh no, we're gonna have a way to approve this as part of the process in 1906." So that's a number of franchise agreements, all spanning about 20 years, I think exactly 20 years. And you're hearing us today because the current agreement expires in December of 2026. So we will start with the new agreement January 1st, 2027. And we want to get ahead of things. So how are we doing this? Well, it's a lot of hours of staff input. We've gone back to staff and understood, well, how is the existing agreement working for us? How has that been? We've gotten comments back from staff. Shannon and our legal team and the legal teams from Excel have spent countless hours. Someday you'll need to add that up, of how much time they spent negotiating what the existing agreement looks like and what the future would look like. And then we're moving into public education, into the council process, and then eventually we will get, in November 2025, to a ballot measure and confirmation by the PUC following that. And then we'll be off to the races. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, so the current agreement, the current franchise, you'll see the term there from 2007 to, again, December of 2026. We knew going into this renegotiation process that it would be tricky, because Denver has the gold standard franchise framework for the entire region for Excel partners. And we've seen Excel over the years move to a more templated version of the franchise agreement. So they start with kind of a blank boilerplate. And understandably, this is our opportunity to fit that mold. And we felt very much like Denver could not fit the mold that was in place with the template, that we were different. And a lot of the time that the negotiation team spent at the table was working to diligently demonstrate why Denver is so different, especially as it relates to our international airport, which is serves the entire region, state, beyond the state lines. And so we have spent a lot of time getting to that point. But the existing franchise framework is divided into several documents you see here. There's the franchise proper that talks about utility relocations within our right-of-way, establishes the franchise fee at that 3%, and then provides Denver undergrounding benefits. So that is a fund that is held in Excel, but we can bill against for our undergrounding projects. There is a operating agreement that covers traffic signals, city facilities, billings and payment agreement for service. The street lighting agreement covers coordination on street light repairs. This is probably many of the touch points that we've had with your offices on various street light repairs, replacements, LED replacements, which have happened in the last few years, wattage increases, new poles that keep our community safe. And then we have the Denver International Airport Operating Agreement that specifically talks about the relocation benefits at the airport and on that property. We have the Low Income Energy Assistance and Energy Conservation Contribution Agreement. That will be the test at the end. Everyone has to say that four times fast. And that's talking about low income bill payment assistance and energy efficiency and conservation enhancements. And then finally, the Energy Future Collaboration, which is an MOU document that talks about our shared clean energy and economic development goals as it relates to the future. So that's where we stand today. So we looked at our goals as basically three categories. We joked at the beginning of the process that success for this renegotiated agreement would look very similar to what we have, because again, we have the gold standard agreement. And I know that seems odd on its face, but when you understand the reality of that document and the benefits that it offers us today, it makes sense to try and maintain those into the future. So specifically, those were responsible stewardship of public funds. So to retain those right-of-way benefits that we have that allows us to really maximize our capital dollars that we have within our city budgets to primary project purposes and not utility relocations. And then preserve the strong definition of public projects that will allow us to extend those benefits to other public agencies. Again, going back to that graphic at the beginning where Denver Water and other entities can also utilize that as well. Those all offer services to Denverites. Next, strengthen partnerships and enhance service to Denverites. So that is looking at how we can better do what we do and work together with Xcel to minimize delays and reflect modern energy conservation and regulations, really just doing a better job underscoring these things than the last agreement. And then finally, accelerating that renewable energy transition. So that's establishing a new group, and we'll talk a little bit more about this, and then advancing that clean energy infrastructure. So this is really important to us because this is something that had not been articulated as well in the existing franchise, but we're here. And we really wanted this opportunity to get on the same page with Xcel and chart our path for the future. So where did we land? Well, from a framework perspective, we did make some simplifications because we felt like there were far too many separate agreements as part of this that could be combined and streamlined into one. So we created this graphic, and you all can tell us if you think it's helpful. But basically on your left is the current framework, and it'll show you what we streamlined down into just these four different categories. We took the franchise agreement that was existing, the Denver operating agreement, and the street lending agreement, and made them into one franchise agreement. So that's all in one document. That is primarily driven by that right-of-way agreement. So that's administered by Dottie. And you can see what that does on the right-hand side in the orange. It defines those public projects, it establishes that relocation benefit and the franchise fee, and it manages the street lights and traffic signals. Then you have a separate document, which we felt was important for Denver International because they are subject to different regulations under the FAA. So they have their separate operating agreement that deals with their service and relocation benefits for the airport property in total. And then we have the Energy Future MOU, which is an existing document that we feel like is a great start. However, the Development Innovation Group, the Denver DIG, is now also establishing a forum for this conversation, in addition to the MOU. And then finally, the low-income energy assistance and conservation section, that is now moving to being managed through Xcel and the Colorado Legislature and the Public Utilities Commission. And that is dealing with the utility payments, efficiency programs, and those assistance programs. So what did we achieve? This, again, after hours and months and months, I don't know the total months, a little less than a year, we achieved three main bottom line achievements as part of this. The first is that public projects definition, and this took some doing to make sure that all the CCD agencies, Denver International Airport, Denver Water, RTD, CDOT, National Western, and our special districts could also benefit from the relocation benefits that we are able to see, so they can also leverage their capital dollars and leverage their budgets to be able to relocate things when needed. Second, we achieved the preserving our relocation benefit, which saves Denver over $3 billion in construction costs over this current term. So the existing franchise agreement is saving us over $3 billion in those capital dollars. We haven't estimated what the new franchise will benefit us. That will be interesting to see, but we know there's a lot of development coming in Denver, and this will be just as helpful to make sure that we can leverage and maximize our budgeted funds to the extent possible. We'll also retain our franchise fee, so this is 3% of the annual Xcel revenues that go back into our general fund. Those are just into the general fund. They're not earmarked for anything, but it's over $30 million a year, so that will continue into the next franchise agreement. And then finally, the undergrounding fee that we talked about, which generates about $10 million a year. And we use that for specific projects to make sure we can underground transmission lines and improve the aesthetics as we move down our corridors and make way for other mobility space. And then finally, under streetlights and traffic signals, we are continuing to coordinate on the repairs and replacements. This is the meat of every day's operations, the bread and butter of the way that we coordinate with Xcel, and trying to do that better, trying to share information better, share data better, and make sure that we are on top of the system when we need repairs. So there's probably some specific questions on the specific operating agreement for DEN and why we chose to do the separate agreement. So again, we did that because they have a unique regulation environment for their FAA regulations that are very different. And we also wanted to make sure that we were able to get the fullness of the Denver property, which was a contentious point at the beginning of the negotiation, that they would also benefit from that relocation. So we were able to finally confirm that the entire property boundaries of Den would be included in that the relocation benefit, including the part of the property that is in Adams County, which is pretty significant. And I think, do we not remember what the acres were? 19,000 acres in Adams County. Now this doesn't
a total.
Thank you. I was like, that sounds really big. But for Adams County, this doesn't mean that we would supersede any of their zoning regulations or other regulations that are on their books. They would certainly need to be in agreement for anything that we would do or develop on their property, but this would allow us to reach into that benefit, the relocation benefit, should we need to. And that is now across the entire airport. So huge number of hours that were spent getting to this point, but a really big win for Denverites and for the airport. I said we would get a little bit more into the Denver Development Innovation Group. So where we have an MOU today, this would improve that and modernize it and create a forum for a place to share thinking and collaboration and innovation on how to advance the city's development into the next generation with a real focus on operations, energy goals, planning, where we're siting infrastructure. We would have representatives from the mayor's office, keep me honest on this, the mayor's office, DOTI, CPD, DETO, CASR, DOF, and the DPO, permitting office, and then Excel, of course, to sit around the table and talk about capital planning, grid planning, forecasting, permitting activities, how we streamline permitting, how we make sure that we're moving forward and we're able to resource the needs that are coming up with developers, ensuring that we're coordinating with them, we're planning for that forecasting and meeting those energy and sustainability goals, leveraging new technologies, those types of things. So this will be established and have a forum for conversation, which will be more of a living, breathing MOU that has a place for conversation as opposed to just a document. Next, we wanted to talk a little bit about the affordability programs that we are now kind of moving out of the franchise agreement, but talk a little bit about the history, and Grace is going to take over the next couple of slides about the impact that Excel has had with their affordability programs, as well as their community programs.
Thank you, Cindy. So Excel Energy is committed to offering our is committed to bringing low-income energy assistance to our customers across Denver. And that's why we partner with Energy Outreach Colorado and other trusted organizations to provide that energy efficiency programs, bill payment assistance programs, energy audits, as well as solar garden opportunities in within Denver to all of our customers. And in 2024, this slide covers our partnership with Energy Outreach Colorado, which provided $8.3 million in the various programs to our Denver customers. You can see the breakdown there. The majority of it is bill payment assistance. Next slide, please.
And I should say the existing franchise had a very minimal requirement for affordability programs. It was actually against the law at the time to provide, you probably will say this more eloquently than I, to treat anyone differently and provide them more assistance. So it was a very low dollar amount. It's kind of strange thinking from where we sit today, but over the course of the 20 years, only a couple million dollars set aside for that. This is wildly different, and the practice, even outside of that, that Excel has is demonstratedly much more investment into the community.
Agreed. And this is a really great example of it. Our Red Truck program we launched in June of 2024. And in 2024 alone, we did go to over 48 grassroots events throughout the city and county of Denver. The Red Truck is staffed with customer care professionals that are able to look up our customers' accounts on site and sign them up to the various programs that they are that they qualify for. So all the different programs that we listed earlier. And we are, you know, investing more deeply into our Red Truck program. We are buying three more Red Trucks. So we hope to be at many more events this year in 2025. but really bringing our services to community where they feel comfortable talking about their utility bill and the various programs that we can sign them up for on site. And if you're interested in having our Red Truck come to an event, we are happy to partner with all of you and your neighborhoods in the coming years.
Okay, so we have sped through the overview of the document today, the document that's proposed for tomorrow. We're really pleased with where this landed and pleased that all of the hours were fruitful and we're at a place where we're in agreement with where we are. It is a strange little document. I think the challenge in our public engagement conversations will be separating rate setting and those types of things from this document. This document has nothing to do with what folks pay for their electricity. But I do think that the benefits speak for themselves, especially in our ability to leverage our dollars further for capital projects and capture the good working relationship that we've built over many, many years with Xcel and will continue into the future as we take on further electrification of our development projects across the city. So now as we move into the timeline, what do we have to do to actually get this done and approved? Well, right now we're in our city council process. So that's, you guys are the first stop after many briefings and discussions. We're very much still happy to come and answer specific questions, obviously here or offline. We will be up next at Finance and Governance Committee. That will be the actual ask. So this is really more of a conversation today, no specific asks. There will we will be asking you to approve the document and move it forward so we can get to a referral conversation. That referral conversation and the agreement on the contract will be July 14th for first reading, and we will have a courtesy public hearing at that time, and then 21st for second reading and ballot referral. So that is how that will move, and we will be set up for the voter approval at the November election. Ongoing to that, we've created a webpage on Denver.gov. We've never had any sort of information about this franchise agreement for really the history of the agreement. You really had to know it was there and ask for information about it. And we wanted that to be much more transparent because it's difficult to understand what it includes and what it doesn't include. And so that is now live and available. And for anyone watching, you can just Google or put into the Sunny. You can ask Sunny for more information on the franchise agreement. It'll take you right there. We'll be employing the Red Truck that come out at different community events and providing other educational materials. Let us know how we can support you through your newsletters or meetings that come up. Happy to do that through the summer. And then in the fall, we will have, again, the election. And then it will move on to the Public Utilities Commission approval and then final ratification by City Council. So there's multiple stops in this, and we hope to have everything done so that we're just ready to go on January 1st, 2027, with a seamless transition from one document to the other. And so here's the specific requests broken down for you. So the Xcel franchise agreement itself requires council approval, the public approval, and then PUC approval. The DEN operating agreement is the same, council approval, public approval through the election, and PUC approval. The DDIG does not, but we feel like this is a great time to establish that, make sure it is a part of our working relationship with Xcel, and it's a forum that we lean on to make sure that we are planning well for our future. And that is the ask that you will see again at FinGov. And then the term will go through 2046, which sounds wild, but here we are, December 31st. I'll start anew on January 1st, 2047. If you'd like to learn more about any of the things that we've kind of hinted at here, here's a list of resources for you and for anyone watching. We're trying to also build out our website to point folks who have billing questions to the Xcel website, or if they want to report an outage to the Xcel website. And then we'll have a lot more information about the franchise itself, affordability programs, those types of things. So here's some straight shots to those locations, but very willing to take any feedback on that website if we can make it better or more accessible or answer any specific questions that you're getting, because we will start to hear those, I think, even after today as this goes more into the public. We're happy to update that, and we'll plan to do that. That will live on through the life of the franchise. We don't intend to take that down after the vote. And that's all we have for you. So we've got, again, a number of folks in the audience and ourselves, so happy to entertain any questions. We've got a while. We've got, I think, another good long while to entertain whatever you guys have for us. Thank you.
Thanks. We have several people in the queue. First up, Councilwoman Alvidres with Councilmember Flynn next.
Thank you, Council President. Thank you all for the presentation. Thank you, Grace, for your work on the South Broadway, especially with all our power outages out there. One of the questions that I have had, and I did raise this to Dottie as these conversations began, is that my understanding is that the Arapahoe gas plant in my district and the Cherokee gas plant in GES are high sources of pollution for those neighborhoods. And I was wondering if that was part of this conversation as far as shutting them down.
So it's not part of this conversation. I think at Arapahoe, we have right now a solar garden as well. As far as Cherokee, it's in Global Elyria, it's not in Global Elyria, Swansea. Okay. It's in Commerce City. It is an unincorporated Adams, but we, what it dispenses into the air is steam. It is often connected to the Suncor plant, which is the neighbor of Cherokee, which does other, you know, other work than what we do at Cherokee. So
but Arapahoe in my district is also a big concern. So the Sierra Club brought forward that it is a source of NOx and SO2, which is found to be harmful to neighborhoods. And so I'd love to know if at what capacity it's still operating, what are the toxins, if any, that it's releasing, and if that can be part of the conversation. I would appreciate it.
Okay.
Second question is, how much money over the 20 years is committed to Solar Garden?
Over the next 20 years, I'd have to get back to you on that as far as the because those commitments are worked through various cases at the PUC and at the state legislature. So they do change and will change over the next 20 years.
So those are not party to this agreement with the city then?
No, they are not part of the franchise. The franchise is really a right-of-way agreement, how we share and coordinate space in public right-of-way. We will have a chance to address some of these things through the DIG coordination and planning as we're siting new infrastructure that's needed for electrification. There will be opportunities to review existing infrastructure in the communities and the neighborhoods and see how we can pivot to a cleaner model like geothermal, which we actually have a pilot in your district at Ruby Hill with a couple different public buildings where we're testing a geothermal option for our customers in Southwest Denver. So there, I think that those conversations will really be had at the DIG. In order to better understand the needs and the wants of Denver's residents and how we can work better together to plan for infrastructure that is cleaner.
Okay. And then when the undergrounding, I know, has been an ongoing issue. I understand that the reason why undergrounding can't always occur is because people need to upgrade their services. And so I'm curious, is there an actual equity plan to how we can actually use those undergrounding fee funds?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and undergrounding is typically associated with the capital projects. So as projects are identified and designed, that often will provide a lot of additional space for like widened sidewalks and more amenity zone and separation from the traveling. So that's where they're prioritized right now. And we can give you information on how that's been spent so far. And then the planning process for how that's decided is really through prioritized budget process, right? It's through our capital projects and what gets approved through at the annual budget or bond projects, for example. So it's really more of a leveraging tool.
I guess that's concerning when I think about the West Side, which has a lot of overhead lines. And right now there's some infrastructure improvements to federal, and I'm pretty sure they're not undergrounding lines. So at what point do we get that? And if we're just doing it based on capital projects, if capital projects keep going to wealthier neighborhoods, how are we going to ensure equity if that's not baked into the agreement?
Well, that is baked into the prioritization of the capital projects themselves. So we always use our equity index to identify what projects are being prioritized for the limited amount of capital dollars. But it is a great point. And we have done, you know, federal and others that have, you want to take this?
Yeah, I'll add that we do have an undergrounding project right now that's actually going up, that's going west along Florida adjacent to Ruby Hill, which we've been working on for like 2.5, 3 years. Mm-hmm. When you under, we underground transmission lines through that fund, not distribution lines. And to your earlier point about additional fees for the customer or to upgrade their panels and things like that, that would be if there was distribution line undergrounding. Typically, we, especially with this fund, we really focus on transmission lines because that's those are on public property and our and distribution lines go down public property through an alley, as you can envision, like a distribution line, and then connect to each home along that line. Mm-hmm. If those were to be undergrounded, there would need to be a fund to go through the private property and dig up that backyard. And then there would be a necessity potentially to change out the power box on the individual's home. So that typically is cost prohibitive to be used with the undergrounding fund. So the focus is really in partnership with the city and relocation and public projects. Those funds are typically used there. So there is one in on Florida, and there has been several along federal as well.
Yeah, and there, not to say that there aren't barriers to using the undergrounding fund. Usually the barrier is right-of-way. There's not enough right-of-way in order to be able to adequately bury and put the infrastructure underground without a tremendous amount of right-of-way acquisition, which would then blow the project budget out of the water. This is the discussion we were having about Evans, which is a potential challenge too, but obviously a great candidate. Can you do it? Absolutely. It just takes more budget for that to be done.
And I would say like the Tennessee Trail in Pathmore Park would be a great opportunity. We have a ton of land there, and there was infrastructure improvements. When those infrastructure improvements came, there was no undergrounding of those lines. And mm-hmm. so I'm seeing a discrepancy in like saying that when we do capital improvement, we're undergrounding lines and actually what I see. So
yeah,
I just want to
add
that.
Other barriers.
And then the last question that I'll have for the moment is just, we had sent a proposal to Dottie around the purchasing of our poles that could save $200 million over the next 20 years. And I'm curious, has there been any thought or was that report taken into consideration in any of these conversations?
So that's the idea of municipalizing the infrastructure. So for those that aren't familiar, this has been a conversation across the United States for, you know, different cities that don't own their own power infrastructure. For us, and I think even locally, Boulder has toyed with it. There's been other municipalities within the state that have looked at this. We certainly have looked at that report. There is a tremendous amount of investment that would be needed in order to purchase that infrastructure from Xcel and then own and operate it. We are not in a financial situation to do that at the moment. Right now, we are budgeted just enough to handle the repairs that we pay Xcel to do for us. So it's not to say that that's off the table, and there is absolutely nothing in the franchise agreement that would preclude that from happening at any point in the franchise. So if we do decide that's a priority for the city, that is very easily done, and this agreement would sunset.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I should have done this earlier, just wanted to acknowledge Councilman Gonzalez Gutierrez and Councilman Torres to the meeting. Thank you for joining us.
Okay.
Next up, we have Councilmember Flynn and Councilman Sawyer on deck.
Thank you, Madam President. I have three questions. Hopefully they can be briefly answered, but just for the benefit of folks watching, the franchise agreement is the only element of the framework that goes to voters, correct? Just so everybody understands us, the DIA operating agreement does not go to voters. The Energy Future MOU does not go to voters. Is that correct?
I believe that the operating agreement, can I get a note? Just the franchise? Yep. So this is incorrect.
That is correct. Okay. So then my question, follow up to that is, are the DIA operating agreement, Energy Future MOU, and the low-income energy assistance and conservation elements of the framework, are they referenced at all in the franchise agreement? Are they included by reference at all? Or are they completely independent?
The framework. So the low-income energy assistance agreement existed as of 20 years ago, it's now been replaced by this whole other superstructure.
Which is from the legislature and the PUC.
Right.
So then, we have, that was my third question.
Yeah.
And so then, we have no role in low-income energy assistance.
We're sort of writing a role into the DDIC where we will discuss programs as Xcel sort of seeks to go to the Public Utilities Commission with other proposals for low-income energy assistance. And as things stand, Denver tends to speak at the Public Utilities Commission no matter what Xcel is doing, much, I think, sometimes to Xcel's chagrin. But we just sort of are writing that into the framework as something that we should have conversations about as new programs are evolving. Because as you can see, like, five new programs have evolved over the last 20 years, and we didn't really have a role in that discussion.
Okay. So, is there a framework agreement as well that encompasses all this?
This is the DDIG agreement, which we are working on. We've been trading drafts. I got the most recent one from Xcel on Friday.
Thank you. Last question. Well, I see the definition of public project. I'm wondering, are there secondary or tertiary projects that could fall under that? I'm thinking of a private developer. It's, let's say, an affordable housing company that, because of city requirements, must do something in the right-of-way that would necessitate a relocation of an Xcel line. Would that be at Xcel's expense or at the developer's expense?
That would be at the developer's expense.
Really? Okay. So it's a very strict definition of public project.
It's a pretty strict definition. Where we started with Xcel at this point was where they started with every other municipality, which was only things that are like 50% or more done by the city. And where we've ended is the only things that are really excluded are metro districts.
Right. I remember that from the briefing we had, that we're lucky to have all this extended definition of public project.
It would be nice to push them even further. Grace, you want to go back to the drawing board?
Oh, no, friend. It does include, you know, important governmental agencies like RTD and Denver Water and CDOT, where we partner together in the right-of-way frequently in the city and county of Denver.
Right. Okay, but when our planning department or DOTI might require a private developer, an affordable housing developer, or a commercial developer to do something in the right-of-way that means Xcel lines must be moved, that's at the developer's expense.
Yes, if it's being paid for by the developer, if there isn't more than 50% paid for by some public governmental entity.
Excellent. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Madam President. That's all.
Thank you. Next up, we have Councilwoman Sawyer with Council Pro Tem Romero Campbell on deck.
Thanks, Madam President. Thanks, you guys. I know this was a huge lift and really appreciate all the work you have done. I am a little bit nervous about bringing it to the voters because the voters are real mad at Xcel. And so the two most frequent things we hear in my office, I'll just take them kind of one at a time. The first one is streetlights, right? There are streetlights in Lowry that have been missing since 2021, 4 years. So does this agreement clarify the requirement of timing for when those streetlights are replaced? Ones, not new ones, ones that have been knocked down by a car accident and never put back up again.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to go? Do you want to?
I would say not to that level of a timing. No.
There's no timing. I will say, in large part, most of the maintenance requests that we have, or new construction requests that we have through Xcel, have been very fast. The exception to that is new poles that have been on back order. You know this story.
Sure. Yeah, I'm not talking about new. Yeah, no, go ahead.
To replace an old with new.
It's fully gone. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I know that we have a few that are outstanding. I'll have to see if they're the Lowry ones that are still waiting on poles. But to Grace's point, there is not a specific timeline because it's recognizing the fact that there are external factors that that will impact when they have availability with the materials to get it in.
We have worked on that quite a bit this year, and I know that we work really closely with your office on your streetlight
really
request.
Appreciate.
And I really appreciate, since you all know that, unfortunately, our streetlights are not smart. We don't know when they're out. We do rely on people to report the outage. And so we have, you know, we maintain over 64,000 streetlights in the city and county of Denver, and I believe over 14 different types. And so we do try to replace them like for like. Sometimes, and I can't say for sure on the ones that have you've been waiting on in your district, but sometimes we can no longer purchase that same equipment to replace it like for like, and we then manufacture it custom in our shop on 3rd and Lepan in order for it to be replaced. So there's a number of factors that go into it. I know that the timeline, we've really worked very hard this last year to make it as short as possible. We worked directly with Terry on those requests and directly with Parks and for the ones that, you know, might go out in city parks, understanding, of course, that our constituents view lighting as a part of safety and an important part of safety. So we do try to do that as quickly as possible, but agree that there's a ways to go in coordination and getting those done more quickly. I know that, for one, we have started to stockpile the most basic parts that we have, which we weren't the way we're regulated, we weren't able to do that in the past, and now we can. So that's helped a lot with the supply chain issues that sometimes we have with some of the poles that we are able to order parts for.
Okay, I really appreciate that. And I know you guys are working your hardest, and you have been fantastic at partnering with us to make sure that the, you know, we're getting them up and replaced as soon as possible. We have 17 missing streetlights in District 5 right now that have all been knocked down in car accidents and have not been replaced. We do a drive around every month and we count the orange cones. And we have been doing this since 2021. So I know, because we have these kinds of conversations, how hard you guys are working. My residents don't. All they see is that they did not get the streetlight that they have been waiting 4 years for. And so I am very concerned about sending this to the voters when we have these extreme service gaps that our voters see and feel, right? And they're the ones that are going to have to vote on this. So I don't want this to fail. Mm-hmm. I want this to go through, because our partnership with you is really important and really valuable. And I want to make sure that the messaging that we are sending to our voters is like identifying those issues and making it clear that there's some resolution coming sometime, because what they see is that they've been waiting 4 years for streetlights. So I don't know how that's above my pay grade on how you guys want to do that, but yes, it has to be done. The second one is utility shutoffs. So we have, council members Torres, Cashman, and I have been working for 2 years with CPD on legislation that is just about to come through. We have vacant and derelict properties that are attractive nuisances. And the reason they're attractive nuisances is because the utilities haven't been shut off. Mm-hmm. And so there's still electricity there. There's still gas there. Sometimes there's still heat there. And that means that people want to be there. And there are a lot of illegal activities that are occurring in a lot of those spaces as a result of that, right? We can't require you to shut off those utilities to make them not so attractive to illegal activity. We can require, and frankly, these private property owners should already be maintaining their property so that people can't get into them. But we don't live in a perfect world, right? So the other thing our residents see and feel is that these vacant and derelict properties are being used for illegal activity because there's still energy. Mm-hmm. In those buildings. So one of the things CPD recommended was that specific instance be written into this agreement as a way to ensure that our vacant and derelict properties in particular have their services shut down. Is that in this agreement?
It is not, because our disconnection program is ruled by the PUC in a rule. We call our rules of the PUC tariffs, which I know is not a great word.
No, it's not.
But and it doesn't really make sense in the end, because it's rulemaking, right? It's really the name of our rules as how we're governed under the PUC, under the state. Our disconnection tariff spells out very specifically how and when we notify the customer on record about a disconnection. From a customer protection standpoint, consumer protection standpoint, it's written so that we don't just shut someone off for an unpaid bill, right? So we have a very specific notification timeline that we have to adhere to, including how we notify and when the customer on record. Unfortunately, the customer on record is not always an the property owner themselves. And we try not to get involved. In fact, our rules say that we don't get involved with landlord and tenant issues. So we work with the customer on record who opened the account with us. So I know that this has come up in the past. I recognize from the derelict building side of things how we need to work very closely with DFD and with DPD to shut off energy as quickly as possible for those buildings that are deemed unsafe for the neighborhood. Sometimes it can happen much more quickly than others. I know in your district last year we had the Oneida property, which was an extra layer of fun because
of
those
probate.
Well, and also all those properties were listed under different addresses and different customers of record. Mm-hmm. So it gets a little complicated for some properties, but we have worked in the past closely with both DPD and DFD. We have examples in other parts of the city. For instance, on 17th and Logan, a few months ago, we were able to shut off in less than 24 hours both of those when there was some folks squatting in that building, right? So it just kind of depends building to building, but it is, if it would need to change, it would need to be changed at the PUC level in our rulemaking that would then cover our entire service territory in Colorado.
So question, I guess, for you all then, you say you testify at the PUC all the time. Is that something that you have brought to their attention, that there's an unintended consequence of a really good policy of not shutting off people's utilities for just a single paid bill?
I would say that the climate office is typically who weighs in on us at the PUC, and that's something that can potentially we can take back and work better together on.
I think it would be great. Yeah, because again, like, I don't want this to fail. We need this agreement with you, and you guys are fantastic partners with us, but our residents have to vote on this, and our residents are mad because all they see are people squatting in the empty building next door or across the street because there's still electricity there. Yeah. And right. That is, it's putting you, Excel, not you, Grace, you, Excel, in a really tough position. It's hard. They're nuances, right? And it's hard to campaign on nuance. So I just want to flag that for you, too, because I do think it's really concerning. So
I appreciate that. I think it's also something that we're committed to working with CPD on through DIG.
Okay.
Maybe there's a way to coordinate those properties in a more streamlined way.
Yeah.
So we're aware of them and we're not just reacting when we hear back from DPD or DFD.
Yeah, that would be a great, I think, proactive thing to do if DIG is the way to kind of get that done as opposed to the franchise agreement. I think that would be fantastic. So
okay.
Thank you. Thanks, Madam President.
Thank you. Next up, we have Pro Tem Romero Camel with Parity on Deck.
Sure. Thank you, Madam President. I just had a real quick question. I appreciate the question about the street lights, so I won't. That horse has been beaten. Okay. The Denver Impact Report that you have for the community outreach, are those the numbers? And the participation, is that determined by what dollars are available, or is it determined by need? Are there wait lists, and are there other goals that you'll be setting into metrics moving forward?
It's dependent on dollars that are used, because I think the dollars are actually much more than that potentially for the city and county of Denver. And this is my understanding is that there's been funding left in most of those buckets, and that's why I think it's a priority of the DIG to better coordinate with the city to make sure that we're using fully all of those programs and making sure that our customers in Denver are aware that they can likely qualify for them and get them signed up for them. I know that we've been working with Human Rights and Community Partnership with some of the nonprofit organizations that they partner with, we partner with as well, not just Energy Outreach Colorado, but like Grid Alternatives, Mile High Youth Corps. Some of those groups we fund through our foundation as well. So I think it's a matter of working better together to get the word out, to sign up as many customers as possible to the programs, because the funds are there.
Yeah, same with the Little Red Trucks, to go into community to make sure they're aware that those programs are available to them, because it's not apparent.
Right. And we recognize that someone might not want to speak with Excel at the Red Truck at an event about their utility bill, right? So making sure there's a warm handoff to one of our trusted partners that are working in community to make sure that our customers have that information and are able to sign up.
Thank you. I'm also wondering if some of the criteria to be able to qualify for those, if those could be, you know, expanded so that you could serve more folks. I think that there might be some additional people who'd participate, but just looking at what those qualifications are or to be able to participate would be helpful.
Those disproportionately impacted customers and income qualified customers, those definitions are set either through state legislation or through the PUC. So I think that that's something else that in our continued partnership with the Climate Office and with, you know, through the DIG, that we can hone in on how do we work together to maybe expand those definitions, or, you know, what do we really need to meet to help our customers in Denver.
Thank you. Yeah, we've got a lot of people who live in apartments in Southeast Denver, a lot of seniors, and so I know that that would be a tremendous support for them. I don't have another question, but this is just more for our colleagues, and in full disclosure, I know that I've spoken with our city attorneys, and Grace is a cousin, but it doesn't qualify for, it's not a conflict of interest, and I've spoken with our attorneys and code of ethics, and just wanted to put it out there for full transparency. And that's it. Thank you, Madam President.
Thank you for your time. Next up, we have Councilman Parody with Lewis on deck.
Yeah, thank you guys, and especially thank you for the time that you've spent briefing all of us, because this only comes up all, you know, so often, and so usually I'm sitting here saying, oh, for the new council members, this is new, but to a degree, it's new for most of us. So just thank you for the time. One thing I'm curious about is there something we could see that's a little more concrete? I'm seeing a lot of, like, sort of categories of negotiation, and I'm glad that the two teams feel good about where that came out, but do we have a draft agreement or a term sheet or something like that? And I'm sorry, because I maybe should already know that, but we could review at this point in time.
You received that.
Okay.
Yeah, you should have a red
line. Did you say we did already?
You have the franchise and the red line.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, franchise. Okay, great. Yeah, I had a feeling that may be already there. Are we, one thing that in just looking at slide 6 up here that talks about the structure of the different agreements, I've been chewing this over because, again, you all have told us that this would be the structure. It's not like this is a surprise today, but I worry a little bit about the Energy Future MOU being sort of separated out from this agreement and put into this new innovation group, because it just makes me worry that, I guess, as the city, that we lose the leverage of this very important agreement, and that we're sort of, you know, putting a lot of that climate change related stuff off for the future. So I'd love to know a little bit more about what the main agreement does in terms of meeting our climate goals and how we're quantifying that.
Energy Future was always a separate agreement. It wasn't yeah, part of the franchise.
But I mean, I'm wondering, it feels to me like it perhaps should be. So I would be curious what in the main agreement is intended to ensure that we are able to meet our climate goals or to improve over the last agreement in some way in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it's appropriate for the franchise because, again, it's really focused on the right-of-way agreement piece and the relocation benefits associated with that. And this is, again, supposed to be more of a forum where we're talking about our shared values and our goals and how to get there in terms of electrifying and moving into the future. I think that is where there's not teeth, so to speak. It's not a legal agreement beyond an MOU. But I think that's, it's a good comment to get now as we're finalizing that draft and see how to beef that up as part of this. And so there aren't any metrics right now in the franchise.
Okay. And go ahead.
I would just add that, you know, our Energy Future Collaborative MOU focused a lot on how do we maximize savings for our customers in the city and county of Denver through our rebate programs to make sure that they spoke well to each other and then, you know, again, that our customers can maximize their savings. For the most part, a lot of that work has already been done. We meet regularly with the Climate Office for regulatory filings that are coming up and to plan for various pilots that we're doing together in the city, including the Ambient Loop Project, which is a pilot where, you know, we're studying taking 14 of the city buildings off of steam and putting them on this ambient loop. We also, I already referenced the geothermal pilot that we're partnering with the Climate Office on in Ruby Hill. We also have one that we're studying for the Ball Arena River Mile project. So those are active conversations that we're having weekly with the Climate Office and that will be further coordinated at the DIG. There is a section of the DIG MOU that speaks to our shared values and investing in new infrastructure and new technology that will help us build a cleaner grid. And so that's where I think the natural evolution of our partnership with the Climate Office as they've grown and changed and we've grown and, well, maybe not grown, but we've changed, have evolved to now is how do we work better together to permit this new clean infrastructure and what are the pilots that we need to continue to partner on to make sure we get there.
And that's exactly, you've partially answered what I was going to ask about next, but the thing I was curious about on, I think, the next slide down is the shared data and information sharing, because I think that, this one. So this talks about strengthened data and information sharing, and I was curious, because that does seem like where we could build in some of the climate work and things like that, so I just would love to know what that includes and whether there's any, that seems like an area where as we talk to more of our like outside partners and, you know, council talks about this amongst ourselves, I wonder if that's an area where there could still be a little bit of conversation.
I think so. I mean, I think it really depends as we're going through the DIG, you know, the different projects, what levels of data sharing need to be discussed and how often mm-hmm. and what kinds and when. Some of the data sharing we've done in the past with the Climate Office has been around where our customers sign up for the various programs and how we can work better together to sign up more people. Mm-hmm. But yes, I think that's something that's still and will be negotiated throughout the next 20 years.
And as an example of that, I've heard from some consumer groups that there's interest in figuring out whether we might, and we would sort of need to start with data, right? And then potentially a pilot to do this. And so I think it's that's really where it falls. But could we look at whether different rate paying models could be appropriate for some kinds of businesses as a way of offering some business relief, like people that use really different energy loads throughout the day, things like that, like be able to figure out if less flat rate structures could make sense for some parts of the city. So I just would love to, when you say strengthen data and information sharing, I would love to hear more about what is strengthened or what has changed in that regard, I guess.
Yeah. I think it's something we can talk about. I think this is really focused around in the franchise itself, the existing access to information and data that we have about where the infrastructure is and how it's operating and its condition.
Sure. Council members.
Yes, exactly. That it more so than the what you're describing is exactly what the forum of the DIG is created for, is to say, okay, look, in order to innovate, which, you know, those are ideas they could absolutely come up with and say, this makes a lot of sense for us right now to charge people differently. Let's be innovative about how we're doing that. We're balancing the load at different times. That seems like a very appropriate forum, but I don't know that there's a relationship between the two and the franchise because it's right of way versus development.
Okay. Correct. And I would say that, you know, any, you know, our rates change with a very public process at the PUC with a rate filing, and the Climate Office always does weigh in on every one of our rate cases and all of our cases at the PUC. And because we have really regular communication with the Climate Office around things happening at the PUC, I think it would be a matter of partnering and seeing how and when and if we should be changing our tariffs around rates, because that would be a change that would have to happen at the PUC.
Which, to your point, are highly separately regulated. Okay. And then am I right about the DIG? I was curious whether it looks like it doesn't have council representation on that, and that's because it's a fairly technical group, I think, but was curious if there would be openness to that, and I don't think we've, my office hasn't brought that up previously.
Well, we're going to have a separate advisory committee, which would include council, okay, council and community representation.
To the DIG?
To the DIG, so that, which would incorporate a lot of voices.
Great. Last question. One thing we did raise in some of the meetings throughout the negotiations with the city negotiating team was the San Diego Equity Fund, where they negotiated a certain amount of money that came from shareholder funds as opposed to ratepayer funds, okay, that would go towards low-income consumers and solar. I was curious if that idea came up in negotiations.
I would say that it's a you know, the San Diego is a municipalized utility, and so because of that structure being very different from Xcel Energy's structure of our ratepayers being across the state, it did not come up as part of our negotiations, simply because our equity programs are already regulated by the PUC and the state legislature, which require us to work directly with our low-income and disproportionately impacted customers. And in, actually, when you look at the numbers across the entire state, they exceed what San Diego invests. Potentially. I mean, I haven't taken a very close look at where and how they're investing, but I think the structure, given that they're a municipalized utility just for San Diego versus our structure, really didn't enable us to have that conversation, because the franchise, again, is about the right of way and not about these equity programs that we are regulated through the PUC for.
Okay. Last question, if that's okay, Madam President. What's the public process from here, as far as, like, I don't know if the city or Xcel or the two together will be trying to get more public input. I know there was one kind of consumer advocates meeting, but what is planned from this point forward?
Yeah, there is nothing formal, although we do have a number of stakeholder groups that we are providing information to. Our website is available. We're hoping that this generates some conversation, may get picked up, and the Red Truck existence at various events, but nothing formal. We're happy to go if you know of some that would like to have one of us come and speak. But beyond that, we're just hoping that this public conversation, go ahead.
No, I would just add that we've already started doing a lot of education and presentations with different stakeholder groups, and we as Xcel are happy to go and do presentations throughout the summer as this goes through the council process. So, you know, we can think of a lot of different stakeholders that might be interested in better understanding what the franchise is and what the franchise isn't, and how it benefits the city and county of Denver, not just through the $30 million annual in franchise fees, but also, you know, the benefits of relocation and undergrounding fund, and then the other programs that we are committed to providing for the city. But yes, I think, you know, once it's referred to the ballot and we start a campaign process, the city would step away at that point, and then we would run a campaign for the November ballot with, you know, various tactics that we would need to run a referendum campaign on a November ballot. Mm-hmm.
So from the city perspective, we're really trying to do what we're doing here is really
technical
education. Here's what it does. Here's what it's not, which I think, again, to some of the points that we've been hearing, is going to be the tough piece of differentiating. This is really about the right of way, but we know there's these other feelings and opportunities that we have with our relationship with Xcel. Here's a great off-ramp for that. The DDIG is one of those. Here's how you get involved. Here's who's represented. Here's the advisory group. Here's what, you know, if you have specific interest in environmental or others or the PUC conversations, here's how you get plugged into those places. But this is really just a nuanced little right-of-way agreement that's wildly important for making our projects pencil at the end of the day.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam President.
Thank you. Next up, we have Councilwoman Lewis with Watson on deck.
Hi. Thank you. Two quick questions. I had a similar question about the DIG as council member of Parity, and it sounds like there's no council representation because you have council members on the advisory committee, panel? What?
Correct.
What is that?
Committee. What would it be?
Can you tell me what the advisory committee is?
So we were thinking that, you know, the core city departments that would help us work better together in coordination, planning, and siting our clean infrastructure, And the Excel departments that are part of capacity planning and permitting would all meet more regularly, likely once a month or some kind of very regular cadence to not lose momentum in between meetings. And then our advisory committee, we would update. I don't know if we have a formal cadence, likely quarterly or something not as frequent, just to make sure that we're touching base with the advisory committee that would include representative from council, representative from like the environmental space, a representative from like the developer space. We were thinking it would be good to have someone from the affordable housing space, given that it's such a priority for all of us to be listening to affordable housing groups, et cetera. So there's a list of potential folks that would sit at the advisory committee to give us feedback on the direction we're going and what we're focusing on in the monthly coordination meetings.
So you all would bring recommendations to the advisory committee on a quarterly basis, and they would give you all feedback, and you all would then incorporate that into whatever that recommendation may be?
I think we'll potentially, yes. I mean, in a perfect world, yes. I think that, go ahead, Shannon.
We would also just be open and interested in the advisory committee's thoughts on what kinds of things we should be working on. And we have some core purposes here. Excel plans to spend $22 billion over the next few years working on distribution and transmission extensions. And as you know, like just all over the city, we've had problems connecting new projects, especially affordable housing projects, to service. So just sort of working that out so that Excel spends its infrastructure money wisely in a way that facilitates and supports our comprehensive plan and our goals is sort of like technical work that I don't know that a council member really wants to get involved in, just because this is like, you know, this is the permitting offices and CPD and DOTI like really trying to understand where development is going. But I think the advisory group is not going to be sort of rubber stamping whatever this DDIG decides. It's more a question of soliciting information from the advisory group about what other kinds of things you think that we should be working on.
Okay, that's helpful. So, but if council members were interested in diving into those details, would you all then be interested in opening up the DIG for a council member to participate, not on the advisory committee, but actually on the DIG?
I think we can take that back. I mean, okay. I don't see why not.
Part of our problem is like we however many people we get on the city side, Excel wanted to have the same number of representatives on the city and the Excel side. So we were trying to get all the departments in and like really had a role here. And trying to at the same time keep it like focused on the Excel side for who's actually working on this stuff.
Yeah, I think the idea too is, you know, we do have this $22 billion that we're going to invest in distribution investment. And it's like, how quickly can we build this infrastructure to meet our capacity needs across the city to continue to provide reliable service across the city? So, I think that if someone's interested in getting into the nitty gritty, I myself am learning a lot in this role, but it is going to be a lot about permitting and how can we, you know, work better together quickly in the right of way.
Great. I look forward to hearing back from you all about that. And then to your point around the building out and the expansion, I do have a question regarding that, and specifically in the context of my district, because there hasn't been a lot of infrastructure investment, and so it makes it difficult to be able to expand in terms of development because of that lack. And so I'm just kind of curious what you all's plan is to think about the expansion of infrastructure for neighborhoods that haven't seen that expansion in over 20 years.
So in the past, the way that we have been regulated is that we pay ourselves back for infrastructure. The way we're regulated is that we pay a portion of it and the customer pays a portion of it, so we don't overbuild infrastructure. So we build to the need of that area. And this is the first time that we have been approved for a proactive forward investment into neighborhoods we know need that infrastructure upgrade. And so that will be part of, you know, I know that CASR has been conducting a grid capacity study. We, when we got the approval for our $22 billion investment, we've been conducting studies around capacity planning where we know that we will need to put in more infrastructure. And those details are going to be worked out then at the DIG, right? Knowing the that some neighborhoods might need it more than others, depending on where they are and what projects might be coming down the pike in those neighborhoods.
Okay, Grace, thank you so much. And I'll circle back to the dig. I think even more of a reason to have a council member on there, because not only are we aware of the lack in our districts, we tend to talk to each other, and so we're aware of the lack in other districts as well. So thank you.
Understood, thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Councilmember Watson. Oh, wait, Councilwoman Torres on deck.
Thank you, Council President. Thank you for this presentation and the months of briefings from both Excel, bless you, and from Dottie and team. So really appreciate the clarity provided to my office, and it's something I'm uniquely interested in, the franchise agreement and the outcomes. One of my questions, I have three questions on the dig as it pertains to the load forecasting and distribution planning. Help me make sure I'm clear. I know within District 9, we've had recent talks, Grace, you and I, obviously with Dottie as well, concerning development, planned development that's impacted by the forecasting and planning for energy to support those developments. Is this part of that dialogue as far as the dig will be providing a clear forecasting, possibly a grid, a mapping of needs for development based on CBD permits? Talk to me a little bit about what that load forecasting and distribution planning will look like, and how does that scale towards where we're seeing a specific need? I was saying District 9, I've had two developments that have stated that they're concerned that they won't be able to develop because there is not great capacity for that.
So I would say for capacity planning, one of the issues with it is that is timing, right? So the city, when a new development comes in, they go through a concept review plan through CPD, they go through this review plan, and they have to submit certain documents to the city early on, right, the concept. But typically, developments won't know what their power load is until much later in the process as they continue to get financing and really develop the project through the years. And so typically, they won't come to us for a power capacity check until much later in the process that they've started with the city. So by the time that they know their power loads, and that's on the customer, the developer, to work with an expert to figure out what their loads are, when the timing of each of those loads will need to come into play in order to construct and then to have permanent power, and really also the requirements that the city might need might have for EV chargers and you know, eventually a fully electric development. Or right now we have some developers that are already choosing the fully electric development, which impacts their power load even more, their electric load. So once they have that load, currently they then apply, well, they'll meet with us, and they may or may not apply at that time for that capacity reservation. The way we are regulated, we cannot reserve capacity for any project until they've formally applied with us and paid for that capacity upgrade. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to the fact that the customers pay a portion of the new infrastructure in order to power their project. We don't socialize the full cost of that development on our ratepayers across the state. The customer developer pays for a portion of it. But sometimes some developments might take longer to get their financing together. There might be different timelines that they have to adhere to for their different financing, you know, the stack of financing that they'll need to do in order to pull the project off. So they may not decide that they want to apply and pay with us right away because they don't have that lined up yet. But since we are not, the way we're regulated, we can't reserve that capacity for them. The next person, the next development down the street might apply for that capacity sooner and pay for it sooner than the person that came to us the first, you know, down the street before them. So that timeline innately of how a development is developed and planned for and paid for, and the timeline by which we are regulated and how we can move forward with reserving their capacity varies project to project, right? Like, so unfortunately, it's a difficult thing to conquer because And this is where, by working better together with our capacity planning team and with the city, understanding what power loads are likely to come into a neighborhood will help us plan where we're going to proactively invest. So for your district, you know, we have a number of developments going up the Washington corridor,
right,
north of I-70. For those, we knew that we were going to need to build another substation. We are building one at 51st and Columbine in Swansea. That we are going through a permitting process at the city right now to build in order to fully permanently power all of those developments going up that corridor, right? So that we knew ahead of time was going to be something we had to plan for. But I think at the dig is where we're really going to together come up with some solutions, knowing that, you know, developers need help forecasting how much their load will be earlier in the process. Can we work with the city on some formulas that they can then provide through CPD, through the permitting process, for developers to start thinking about what those loads would be and really honing in on a load number earlier in the process so that we can plan together and we can turn them on as soon as they're ready to be turned on? Because unfortunately, that timeline is very different.
And Grace, I appreciate the thoroughness of your answer. I know we're going to be running out of time. I know we have a few other folks. You came around to the answer to my question, and I appreciate the background because it's helpful for folks listening. I think having clarity on a mapping, because we obviously know from our permits the amount of development that's happening in Globeville, Hilaire, and Swansea. We know what's happening on Washington Street. Whether they have that very clearly articulated energy plan in place, there is a forecast based on similar proposed development. And when we have a deeply affordable development that's going up, and they're sending emails to my office saying we may not be able to develop because we don't know if the Poder substation is still going or if we are going to have electricity. That's a question. So I appreciate the dig is leveraging that. I've got two other very quick questions. I know there's other folks in the queue. I know for relocation, as it pertains to utilities, those have a dramatic impact on developments and the ability for developments to occur, especially in underserved communities. And I was curious if there's anyone here from your teams that's working on the Washington Street development, if they can quickly speak to what those impacts have been. Is any of those impacts detailed within, whether it's the dig or whether it's anywhere within the franchise agreement, to make sure that those necessary developments and that undergrounding is done specific to Washington Street in Globeville?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't have those details, but I can absolutely follow up.
I see someone who works on Washington Street. Chris, do you have those? Madam President, may I ask if Chris Callahan? I apologize, and I don't mean to call one of your folks, but.
Yeah, and just to clarify, you're asking kind of how are you ensuring that those kind of undergrounding benefits are
Talk through kind of what that process is, and if you don't mind introducing yourself first, I would greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. My name is Chris Callanan. I'm a community engagement specialist with the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure. I work heavily in District 9 in Globeville and Elyria, Swansea on community engagement, including projects like the Washington Street Corridor reconstruction. Our kind of designers for the Washington Street reconstruction have been working closely with Xcel Energy and doing the important utility relocation work ahead of our primary kind of DOTI construction and capital build out. As a part of that, we have been working with Terry Goodwin, who's our Xcel franchise administrator, to make sure that the utility lines will be undergrounded in Washington Street corridor. So it is on kind of a project by project basis that we negotiate with Xcel and look at our $10 million undergrounding benefit pool to make sure that we're kind of prioritizing that funding appropriately. But yep, we've been in the background working very, very heavily with Xcel Energy to make sure that those benefits are there.
Good to hear. And one quick comment, thank you so much, Chris, on LEAP and kind of the energy assistance. That has been a priority discussion. I had a little unease with understanding these kind of the separation of that, but I fully understand. When you look at the numbers of what we actually negotiated 10 years ago, was what, $2 million?
Mm-hmm. 20 years.
20 years.
Yeah, for 20 years. And the process we currently have that's providing exponential growth in that necessary value-added process to make sure all of our residents have access to energy consistently, and if they're not able to pay their bills, there's support support. So I wanted to thank you all for being very thoughtful and a very sensitive part of your dialogue, your discussions, and providing a really clear, I think, a solid opportunity that's better than what we had before. So thank you so much to Excel. Thank you to Dottie and everyone. Thank you, Madam President.
Thank you. Next up, we have Councilwoman Torres with Hines on deck.
Thank you, Madam President. So quickly, just to recap on low-income energy assistance. In reading a couple of the articles that covered the 2006 agreement, it looked like one of the biggest changes that happened back then was that we applied the 3% tax to the entire bill as opposed to everything over $12.50. So that was a big change. Curious first if that's in line with how other cities have negotiated their agreement, that it is the whole bill and not a portion of the bill.
It is the whole bill.
It is the whole bill for all your other agreements that you've got in place.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. One of the arguments around it becoming the whole bill back in the last agreement was that that funding would be used to fund low-income energy assistance. So just want to make sure that I'm understanding that that isn't being reduced, eliminated. It is covered by another section. I'm seeing in the flow chart that you presented, it's not in this franchise agreement necessarily, but just want to understand how much money Excel puts toward Denver's low-income energy assistance.
I apologize, Shannon. I'm so sorry. I think it's $5.8 million on bill payment assistance in the past year,
right,
and then additional benefits. Total of
8.3 for 2024.
Okay. And does any of that come through our fund that or our
no
fee? So that was how it was relayed last time, that that 3% would apply to the whole bill because some of that money was going to go toward low-income energy assistance.
Yeah, sounds like that was incorrectly reported. Yeah, I think it's there because honestly, because there was like statute that said that they could not treat different customers differentially. The way that agreement was structured was that Excel would cause $100,000 a year, in effect, to be paid for low-income energy assistance.
Okay, maybe it was misreported. Here's the quote. The current fee does not apply to the first $12.50 of these bills. Under the new proposal, the fee would apply to the entire utility bill, increasing the average monthly gas and electric bill of a typical consumer by about 0.6% to generate an extra $2 million for the low-income assistance fund.
Yeah, it feels like they were making
a couple things. Okay.
That didn't exist.
Okay, that's fine. In the goals that were made, and I can forward these just to wrap up, there were four goals that were mentioned in two different articles that covered the 2006 agreement. So just want to see kind of where or how far they advanced or if they're even like relevant anymore. The four that they mentioned was $200,000 to municipal solar power plant, perhaps near Smith Road or the airport. Efforts to make low-income housing more energy efficient. Did that happen anywhere? Work toward purchasing up to 22 megawatts of hydroelectric power from Denver Water, and then reduce the amount of water pulled from the Colorado River. So I'll forward those four questions to you all. Okay, that'd be great.
Yeah,
thank
we
you.
We can follow up on each one.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Councilmember Hines.
Thank you, Madam President. Thank you for the presentation. Thank you for the two briefings in advance of this, which is a briefing, it's not an action item. To Councilmember Sawyer's point, it's not just Council District 5. I know that one of my constituents in March of 2023 involved Robert Kinney, CEO of Excel, because he had been reaching out for 3 years with Excel and Dottie wasn't getting a response. Another constituent, this is open record, so Steve Wiles is the first person, Larry Zeller is the second, was concerned about a 5G tower removed a light pole in a historic district, which is one of the few places where you can legally justify the removal of a 5G pole. So that 5G pole was removed, but the light pole was never replaced. It was in part because it turns out it just wasn't in Excel's inventory, even though it was an Excel pool.
Yeah.
So that was part of the, so I have constituents as well who are concerned about.
I was near Cheeseman.
Yeah,
on Long Island.
Yeah, so I just want to share that I, you know, think in both of my briefing conversations I talked about, well, like us, we regularly, I get emails all the time saying, why don't I enforce Denver's laws? Well, it's in the Constitution, it's in the, you know, the state and federal constitution, it's in the charter that the executive branch executes our laws, not the legislative branch. But people don't care. They know I work for the city, they elected me to do something, and why am I not enforcing the law? So I see that Excel will be similar. Like, I don't care, this is an opportunity for me to vote on something that's Excel related, and I'm very frustrated with Excel. So, you know, they believe this is their opportunity to vote on those frustrations or rate increases or resistance to a rapid transition from fossil fuels. So, just putting that out there because I mentioned that in each of the conversations that we have before now. The last thing I want to say is the stakeholder group, I think it's the DDIG, help me understand why that stakeholder group will increase a rapid transition for fossil fuels, which I believe that's one of the things you've mentioned in our last conversation, and won't be used as a way to slow the transition. You know, Excel already has stated goals, 2040 goals that will come to fruition or not before this before this franchise agreement takes effect. So the limited conversations that I've had with constituents about this, they're concerned that this is that this committee is an opportunity to rehash some of the things that have already been committed by Excel. So could be theoretically used to slow down the transition for fossil fuels as one example, as opposed to in the briefing you'd mentioned that the
supposed to speed up.
Your hope is that the committee will speed up the transition.
Yeah, I think I'll start if you want to chime in too. But I think a lot of it, and you as well, but a lot of the purpose, and you see the folks around the table, and Shannon's described it as kind of the nitty gritty, is to streamline things. Because in a lot of cases, we've heard this from Excel a number of times, is we're the ones standing in the way in that permitting process. We're dragging out the process, we're requiring all of these things to be in place before they're actually allowed to go and build that infrastructure. And so, in one way, that is supposed to streamline. And in the same way that we have built the DPO to try and make sure that, especially with Excel is one of our most frequent flyers in terms of permitting activity, right? Excel, Denver Water, that stands to reason. That because of that, are there ways that we can help without cutting corners of quality and safety, right? That is why we exist in DOTI, to maintain the health, safety, and general welfare of the traveling public. But can we do that and streamline those efforts to get those things out the door faster? What else do you guys want to add?
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, we've been every year increasing our renewable energy on the grid, and I think I may have mentioned in a previous briefing, Councilman, that we have been building a renewable energy transmission line through the Eastern Plains for the past few years, harnessing renewable energy from our wind and solar gardens out on the Eastern Plains to bring it into the Front Range, bring it in from the east into Denver. So a lot of the permitting that I'm hoping we can focus on soon at the DIG is really bringing in that renewable energy through these new transmission lines we'll need to build, so we can actually have more renewable energy on our grid in Denver than we currently have. So it definitely is being spurring us closer to a completely clean energy transition than farther away.
One last comment to Councilmember Lewis's point about wanting to participate in the committee, and you were saying it gets into the nitty-gritty. As much as we are an inch deep and a mile wide, our constituents make us get into the nitty-gritty, whether we like it or not. And so I know far more about permitting or land use or things that are, land use is a direct component of our job. Permitting is an indirect component of our job, but I've learned a lot about permitting. I've learned a lot about 5G cell towers and where they can and cannot be placed. Spoiler alert, can be placed just about anywhere except a historic district. So to Councilmember Lewis's point, sometimes we have to get it in the nitty-gritty because our constituents demand it of us. So, Thank you. Thank you, Madam President.
Thank you. With only 2 minutes left, I don't have time to ask my questions or make comments. We have a delegation from Japan coming. So I'll just save mine I know their tradition is to be very timely, right? So I don't want to be rude to people from our sister city from Takayama. So I'll just save my questions for FinGov that is coming up. And thank you for making that adjustment to go to FinGov where we referred ballot initiatives, ballot referrals to. That makes me feel much better about this process. I do think that public outreach will probably be needed. It's 20 years ago. People are much more familiar with the bond process. People are much more familiar. I know in Northwest Denver, I'll probably get comments. Why don't we have lights in Berkeley Dog Park? They would think that would be Excel, right? Why do we have a lot of times under Mayor Wellington Webb, we had block grants and they put up those beautiful lights like in Highland area, and they're orphaned. They're not Excel's property, and no one can figure out who pays the bill for them to go on and go off. And there's these orphaned lights, like when you take 38th down off of Fox, that whole entire area, all of those orphaned lights. My office gets tons of requests all the time. Hey, can you call Excel? And they're really beautiful, ornate lights. They really do bring, but they were part of these block grants under Wellington uh-huh. Webb, where they were beautification, and we can't for the life of us figure out who, if it doesn't have a local maintenance district attached to them,
yeah.
They're kind of orphaned lights. Orphaned. And then I always say, well, who pays the bill for said orphan lights, which we can't figure out. So I think those are the type of education campaign that we probably will just need in Denver and throughout anywhere that anyone has those ornate lights that are those orphan weird lights that nobody knows about, because that's not part of this agreement. And just really educating, like, what is part of the agreement and what's not part of the agreement. No offense to any engineer who's watching, but not in engineer terminology in real, like, so that my 23-year-old daughter who votes could participate, and my 82-year-old mom, who's probably voted on this a couple times, can participate. But other than that, I'll just save my questions and everything else for FinGov. Thank you all for a really robust conversation, and I'm glad we had the full committee because we ended up taking all of it. So
yeah.
With that, council members, if you'd stay for the next to meet our sister cities, that'd be great. And then we'll convene at 3:30 for our council meeting. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.